organizations are very much over-indexed on the governance side of things. And as a result, I think they're missing opportunities to really like that this technology presents. And we're going to see disruption. We're going to see new entrants in their field. And you need to try to be that disruptor or guard against it.
Welcome to the AI Advantage, where modern leaders decode the future of tech. I'm Solomon Williams, founder of Solenox. So here, it's no noise, no hype every week. Sometimes it's just me, and sometimes it's the brightest minds in tech, breaking down what it really takes to grow smarter with AI and automation. Let's dive in.
Welcome to AI Advantage. I'm your host, Solomon Williams. So we have a special guest today. We have Dr. Michael Hausman. He's the founder of AI Performance Labs. He's the best-selling author, too, for Future Proof. So, Michael, I know you've spent a lot of years, I think it's 15 plus years in like the AI space building machine learning platform. So I'm really excited for you to come on to the show today. Just for the audience, tell us like a little bit about just your career and just how you've gotten up to this point with AI Performance Labs. Just a quick recap.
Yeah, absolutely. I like to start by telling people I'm a technologist first. I once upon a time had aspirations of going into academia. I got a PhD in econometrics 17 years ago. It feels like that's a long time. Instead of going into academia, I had a sneaking suspicion then that all this data being thrown off by SaaS tools and our phones and mobile devices, I thought that's going to be a valuable skill set working with data. So I often tell people I was doing this as a data science before it was cool. And then spent those 15 years working for startups, building out ML and AI platforms, reinventing, hiring e-commerce, lending, fraud detection, and finance. So just kept, working from startup to startup and leading teams of data engineers and developers and so on and so forth. And I think the work I do now at AI Performance Lab, there were two things that led to this starting. Number one is I started going up on stages and doing keynotes and found that for an egghead and a data nerd, I was decently good at holding an audience and getting them engaged. And so, that's a unique skill set. And I know you, Solomon, kind of have that same like intersection. And then the other thing was a challenge I kept seeing over and over, which was we would build all this technology and architecture. We deploy it to clients. Sometimes they saw a ton of value, and then sometimes they wouldn't see the value that we had predicted in our models. And so then we'd go back and say, well, what went wrong? And almost always it was because the human beings at the end of that value chain, they weren't using the tools, they weren't engaging with it. You can build a hiring algorithm, but when you hand it to a hiring manager who's been doing this for 20 years, they'll tell you, hey, I've been doing this 20 years. I trust my gut. Dr. Egghead, you're not going to tell me who. And I realized that's a problem that companies are facing now. And I realized that the way I could help fix that was not by coding, but was by getting in front of audiences and executives and helping them learn about how to harness the power of these tools. So that was the journey that led me to where I am today.
Yeah, I'm so curious, other because it's the same process, right? It's that change management of where you're trying to really break through into a new, it's like breaking someone from, I think of it all the time, from a waterfall with project management, like on how things used to be. Now we're trying to transition into a scrum or agile method, and people are really wanting to break through. That's like we're used to the old way. So I know today, if I'm not mistaken, the AI Performance Lab, you run like a 12-month program, like that's around that. Is that so within that program, I know it's built around more on that. Is it still on that mindset, that skill set, and how the tools are functioning? So you have to get around. Can you walk us through what that looks like for that program?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fundamental pain point is companies are making massive investments in the technology, millions and millions of dollars, and they're often not making commensurate investments in their people. And the analogy, I'm a fitness guy and a CrossFitter. So the analogy I use is like, it's like buying the state-of-the-art Peloton or treadmill or building a home gym. If you don't have the accountability, the mindset, the skill set to use it, we all know it's just going to mothball and it's going to become a coat hanger. So what we found is the sweet spot is the combination of the tool set, which is the tools they have available. It's mindset. So there are mindset shifts that need to happen to really understand the power of AI, getting excited, not fearful, seeing it as a colleague and not just a typical SaaS tool. And then there's skill set, which is hands-on keyboard. Let's show you the latest and greatest. Let's show you how to engage with the tools. Let's show you best practices. And when you do those three things in the right measure and combination, that's when magic happens and folks get it. They have these light bulb moments and they start leaning in and using it to reinvent the work they're doing on a day-to-day basis. And so the way we deliver it is a combination. Like you said, it's not a one-off. You can't go to a personal trainer and say, hey, you know, I want to get jacked. You got a week. Let's do this, right? It's an ongoing journey. It never really ends. And we do online education. We do webinars. We have an online course. We do keynotes and workshops where we show up in front of them and we look over their shoulders. When you do all of those things together, you know, that's when folks climb the learning curve and they inevitably spread it to their colleagues, their friends, their direct reports.
So I'm curious of this because, you know, usually sometimes what you hear of, you want someone to champion it and then they kind of bring that, they champion the tool. Like, let's say, for example, Copilot or agents, and then they bring it down to their team. So in these workshops that you do, is it with the entire, how do you work within that? Is that only with the leadership? And what have you seen there for the most part? Is it usually towards more of the older crowd? Do you see more of the Gen Zers or the millennials on the younger side being able to adapt further? I'm real curious to what the metrics that you see from that.
Yeah, these are great questions. So number one, companies are appointing AI champions. What we've seen and what the research bears out is that AI champions, there's such a big gap between the AI champions and the rest of the rank and file that it's hard for them to bridge that gap, right? They see the power. They're often technologists themselves, and it's hard for them to understand how to connect with folks that are really at the very start of this journey. You know, it's not to say it's a bad idea, but that doesn't help everyone get on that path, on that journey. What we found, and again, the research bears this out, Ian, is that it starts with the leadership team. It starts with, you know, Microsoft did study of what drives someone's individual adoption, you know, whether they're using these tools weekly, daily. It's the one third of it is your own characteristics and your tech footprint. Two thirds of it, double, is leadership and culture. And it's whether your boss models the way, whether they create room for experimentation, whether they prioritize it, whether they embrace these tools. And so we really start with leadership teams and execs. And often some of the pushback we'll hear is, listen, I'm a leader. I have technologists on my team. They're the ones responsible for doing this work. And to that, I say, like, that is not enough. Like, you don't need to be the cutting edge developer. You don't need to be the one that's pushing the envelope with the capabilities, but you absolutely do need to know how to build an agent and work with teams of agents because it opens your eyes as to what the capabilities are, right? This can't be academic. You have to be in the weeds and you have to actually know how to build. And so that's where we go, is we'll go cohorts of 20 or 30 or sometimes even as many as 60 executives. We show them we blow their minds, do the mindset shifts, show them the skills. We get them all coming out of these workshops and these online courses, understanding the capabilities. And the last thing I'll say is what is really an unlock is getting everyone to own a pet project. And it doesn't even need to be something work-related. I worked with an exec at a large, one of those big four consulting companies. He's an L&D leader. He's not technical at all, but he was obsessed. He wanted the smart home of the future, like Jarvis from Iron Man. And so he got it, and he had a bunch of smart devices, but they operated independently and he had a bunch of different remotes and they're all connected to his phone. He built out an agentic brain that manages his whole house automatically. And if it's too light, the shades go down. And if it's too dark, the shades go up. And if it's at a certain temperature, the pool cover opens, but the cameras tell it, hey, don't open now because there's someone standing near it and you're going to kill them. And the point of all this is this guy, who's not a technical person, but he is a leader at the company, understood the possibilities, is obsessed with this project, showed me how it works. And he is now, you know, one of the folks at the forefront of AI for that firm. And so anyhow, that was a long answer to your question, but like those are some of the unlocks that we've discovered in the work that we do.
So I'm glad, I really want to kind of tap into that because you really mentioned something that I'm a big proponent of is someone that is really is empowered by AI that's not technical at all, that doesn't need to know all the capabilities of you know, the architecture. It's just they want a very minimal viable product. They have a very solution, a pain point they want to. So on the LE side for that executive, and from what you have seen, you know, what works? Because, you know, so many people, I would think that on AI, and maybe I can speak for myself, you get so analysis paralysis of it. Like, what can I do? And so from what your side, and really, I love to take your point and from the consulting that you have, how does someone start if an executive is listening to this or another professional? Where can they start? Because there's so much, right? You have Hermes, you on a local AI, you got Fable that's coming out, you have China's new product with Kimi. That there's so much information that comes, it seems like, on a month-to-month basis. Where's the start where they can really see a proof of concept?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And part of our job is to distill all the news and updates to make it much more actionable and accessible to those audiences, because the models are changing every day. I think folks get hung up on the using the exact perfect model. Or like, I'll tell you, like when everyone went nuts on prompt engineering, I thought this is the dumbest thing ever. I get the value of like, hey, you need to, you know, prompting is a skill, but the LLMs are now smart enough to interpret intent. So it's almost like, and frankly, they act like colleagues. So it's almost like saying, hey, I have to talk to Solomon. Here's a recipe for having a conversation with Solomon. It's the who and then the what and the where and the how. So I guess all of that to say, don't get too hung up on some of the nitty gritty details of like the perfect prompt or the perfect tool. What you need to do is build, think of it as a skill set and an AI muscle. And so I would start by, you know, we start by having them build agents, and the agents start doing very simple things like, hey, give me a news summarizer, or give me an email digest, or give me a sense of what my day looks, and do research on everyone I'm meeting with. Like, those are very simple use cases you can build out in like 30 minutes to 30 to 60 minutes. And then we build on top of that and we say, okay, let's identify a bigger work that you might want to automate, right? Let's say you're doing all sorts of like financial processing. Let's break it down into pieces. Let's understand what does that look like. Let's whiteboard it a little bit. And then let's figure out where do we insert the agents. And so you start small, you dive in. You have to, you know, there's no perfect day to get into the gym. You got to start today. It's like you got to dive in. You just start figuring it out. You follow thought leaders, colleagues, and frankly, ourselves, right? We're the ones distilling this information. And then what you see is that those skill sets, those muscles start to grow, and they start to embark on bigger and bigger projects. And they start to, I think everyone has that light bulb moment and that switch when they almost everything they do, now they start asking, hey, how can I agentize this? How could I AI-ify this? Their first reaction isn't to go do, is to take a step back and say, how can I plug the AI into this tool? And I'll say one more thing, because I get really excited about this stuff, is like everyone's using it as a helper. And so here's a crazy unlock, which is make it a combative client, make it a Karen, make it a critic, and then send you that deck you worked on, that report, that email, send it to the AI and say, hey, beat the crap out of this. And I've done that, and it helps you harden your thinking. Everyone thinks, hey, this is just automate the work I do. No. It can help you make smarter decisions. It can help you engage with clients, with colleagues better. So that's a little hack, and it's so easy to just plug something in and say, beat the crap out of this. Tell me what are my blind spots?
I do it all the time when it comes to when I need to kind of build out a landing zone migration, or we need to do migration for Solanox site. I usually use Claude and maybe Codex to kind of go through and do an adversarial adjustment for it. And even then, to your point, it helps you to not think, it helps you to bring forward possibilities or just nuances that you never thought of. And that, again, that helps you to become a better driver in your profession, I think. I think that's so key.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say one more thing, which is, and there's a great quote from Jensen Huang that I play during my talks. And he says, listen, most people are using it so they can think less. I use it so I can think more. And my job as a CEO of this big company is to ask a lot of questions, right? And to start to ask hard questions and use it as a thought partner to help you ask harder questions, to learn about the world, to think more strategically, to solve more complex problems. So that's another one where, like, you know, use it to think. Most people are going to be kind of lazy and say, just do this for me. But I think the ones that are really succeeding are saying, hey, like, you're a thought companion, like, help me think more.
So with that, with it, you know, because everybody wants, you know, the whole, going to your example that you used beforehand, everyone wants their own Jarvis, in a sense. You know, when building out, and I really like, you know, Michael, how you've adjusted to the fitness area on Performance Labs, because it's broken up into the categories, and I really like that approach. With that, people get caught up on context, you know, context windows, and making sure that it has, understands, as you said, we want to think of the agentic as an employee or kind of an intern. You're kind of building up. So with that, where do you start? Does someone, sometimes do they just open up the voice and just build out like a questionnaire of it? I'm sure someone kind of comes in, like, where do we start building the context? And especially for an enterprise that has so much data, you know, from, they have so much of data that's Cosmos, they have SQL servers. So where does the starting point even occur?
Yeah, this is the trickiest part. And I think the thing that not many people are talking about, which is, like, think of it, like you said, think of the AI as a colleague and not a tool. So then if you were to onboard some super talented intern to your company, well, first they need a context, they need memory, they need a big brain with all your data. And every company has data warts. I've been doing it 17 years. I've never run into the company that's like, our data's perfect, it's in perfect shape, we're ready to run. So that's number one, is like, all those data silos need to be combined. There needs to be data hygiene applied. You need to break down the silos, have them talk to each other. And companies are in different stages of that journey. There's memory that exists in people's heads. So what are people doing every day? That stuff needs to be captured. And there are companies like Scribe that help you basically record people's, take screenshots of what people do. And try to, so yeah, that's the first challenge is, if on top of that, you need this layer of knowledge that you can then layer the agents on top of. And not only does the knowledge need to be comprehensive, but in many cases, it needs to be permissioned. There needs to be governance applied, because you wouldn't want that intern to have access to all the company secrets. So that, frankly, is the biggest challenge. But then there's a challenge that, again, I don't hear enough people talking about, which is, what are the rules of engagement? What are the, you know, we all have like a company code of conduct. And when you join, you're expected to know this is how things are done here. But if you're onboarding this new AI agent, it doesn't really know. You can read the code of conduct, but there are special rules for engaging the agent should know. And it should understand, this is our culture. This is the way we do things around here. These are the things you always do. These are the things you do not do. And I'll say one more thing, which is like, and frankly, those are often defined, you know, Claude has the Claude MD file, OpenClaw has the Soul MD file, but all of those are the standing instructions. And I learned this the hard way, because early on, I started playing with agents. I wanted to build like a massive communications hub, because I built an email autoresponder and it would respond to you, Solomon, the same way it responded to my dad. It didn't know context, right? It didn't understand relationships. So I fed it all of my communications data, which was like WhatsApp and messages and email, calendar. You can think of a dozen different applications where it lives. But in the course of working with it, and it was a data engineer, it was really smart, but it didn't know how to work with me. So it would just go and happily run off and destroy an entire section of the database, or it would do something to the entire database and wouldn't run small tests. And it was infuriating, because I was like, you just spent $5. That's not what I would have done. But it doesn't know it. So anyhow, I had to teach it via that Claude MD how to engage with me and the way I like to work, which is, I'm super detail oriented. I like to do small tests. I wanted it to push back. I had to tell it multiple times, like, if you think I'm doing something stupid, tell me. Don't just run off and do it. So anyhow, long answer to your story. It's like, you need the memory, but what no one's talking about is like, you need the company culture for agents to work with. And I don't think companies are really defining that in a very fine way right now.
Because, you know, especially on your side, when you wanted to really take a true assistant or true kind of chief of staff, so to speak, for yourself, it really has you assess how you are as a person, like what works for you and what are your strengths. And sometimes folks don't know. So for you, when was that? As you said, that it you needed that context and those screenshots and kind of giving it. When you started with it, like, where did you kind of work within? Did you just start with just your notepad? I'm just genuinely curious, because brought up such a good point that, you know, most folks don't. I hear about, but they don't go deeper. It really analyzes what me as a contributor or within my profession, am I good at? What are my pieces that I'm, what are gaps? And then how can I best build my agent to better help me to excel into where I want to go and those goals? So can you mind kind of like giving us a little bit more of how you did that?
Yeah. I mean, I think like any relationship, there's a trust that's built over time and there becomes kind of a working understanding of like, this is how we engage with one another. And so when I first started working with agents, I was just paying, I chose a hard project, which was the house party communication sub hub that I mentioned. And I was like, this will be a really good opportunity to see what the agents can and can't do. And then as I started engaging with them, as I saw how it worked and the things it would run off to do, I started building out. I would constantly update that MD file with, hey, this is, I just discovered this and this. Please bake this into the markdown file so that it'll be better in the future. And so it was really, there's no way other than I think learning from experience. And that's why we really prioritize the hands-on skill development with executives, because it's very academic until you're working with an agent and you see what it goes off and does. And yeah, for me, the biggest one was, and I knew this was a bias going in, is syncopancy, which is like, and folks don't realize like the large language models, because of the way they're trained with by reinforcement learning with human feedback, they're trained to give you answers that are going to please the user, that are going to resonate. And that's what produces really good people like that, what they found, but it is very reluctant to push back and it won't question your assumptions and it won't say, hey, hold on, before you do this, are you sure there could be downstream ramifications? Or maybe you're not thinking about this the right way, or just flat out like, no, this is a bad idea. This isn't going to get you what you want. And so, yeah, I would pressure test it. I would ask it. I'm sometimes asked to do stupid stuff to see if it would push back. And over time, I kind of learned, okay, I need to bake into my markdown file. I call them house rules. Again, I call myself house, but like for working with me. And one of them is like no syncopancy, no fluff, be direct. Cause I don't like a lot of over, you know, flowery language, like be direct, don't push back. And that's frankly the way I work with all my colleagues, my teammates, contractors, is like, I value it when they push back, right? When they just go and run off and do stuff, that's not valuable to me as when someone says, you know what? I know what you want to do. I don't think that's the right approach. So,
right. Collaboration. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a learning process. It's trust building. You start to learn what they're good at, what they're not good at. But yeah, it's crazy when you will correct them and they will confidently say something. And then you'll be like, I don't think this is right. And then it'll check. And this happens all the time. And it's like, oh, you're right. That's completely wrong. I gave it a wrong answer. It's crazy, you know? So like you need, there's some trust, but there's also places where you trust your own gut. Don't just listen blindly to this thing.
Exactly. No. And I think that's the key part that showcases. And that's where you kind of get caught, you know, you hear, you know, on the other side of it where, you know, people feel like, especially in the bigger companies, that AI is taking jobs and you hear this, but to your point, if you're a professional that kind of knows and you kind of see the output of what it's giving, you're like, wait, hold on. This is again, I think that it's supposed to empower you. It goes back to what you said, that this should empower you and give you gaps, because with your skill set, whatever it is, regardless whether we're us in IT or in marketing, or maybe you're more on in terms of the legal or the accounting, you're still able to say, wait, hold on, that's not right. You're missing these pieces, or we can't do this. And that, I think that's the key piece that you don't hear about is it's supposed to build off of what you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So having, you know, judgment, and we'll probably talk later, like taste, those are things that it still hasn't subsumed. And I tell everyone, get excited, because what it's good at is repetitive tasks and generative precision. It's good at pattern recognition. It's good at data retrieval. That's the stuff I don't like. I'm not good at. And also, I kind of don't like that stuff. Like, I like engaging with people. I like thinking about complex problems, thinking strategically, storytelling I love. So, yeah, that, to everyone that's nervous about the jobs going away, like, look, some jobs are going to disappear without question, but tons of jobs are going to be created. Your job inevitably is going to change. And I'm willing to bet that it's going to shift in the direction of the things that make you human, the human characteristics that you like about your job. And so I think it's frankly going to, there's a lot of gloom and doom and fear. I think it's just going to usher in an era of just unparalleled creativity and opportunity.
No, I think so too. And I'm 100% in agreement with you for, I'm curious on it, going back to the performance labs for your programs that you do. And because I want to focus just on the leadership that you've seen. Now you've built systems, you're more on the IT side, on the architectures, you know how this works. And now you're coaching executives. So with that, what do you see the SMEs or the technical teams understand that sometimes the board is having a hard time that's still missing, you would say?
Yeah, I mean, I would say folks in my technology friends really get how profoundly impactful this is going to be. Like, I'll give you an example. It was a workshop I delivered last week, 20 executives, one of the biggest oil and gas companies in the world. These are smart guys. First off, ask them, show of hands, who here has built an agent? 20 executives, three raise their hands. So that's just 15%. And then when you ask them, okay, well, what'd you build an agent to do? Two out of the three were just using it as like a brainstorming companion. It's not really agenda. So that's number one, is like huge. My technologist friends won't shut up about agents and OpenClaw. Senior executives at companies have no idea what's happening. And I think the other thing is they have a hard time wrapping their head around what the possibilities are. And so like there's a line I've shared during workshops, and I'll say, anything I can do with my computer, an agent can do. And technologists kind of get that like, oh, wait, having that sort of digital control means it could access databases. It can surf websites. It can, you know, organize. I've been organizing my communications. I had Claude organize all my passwords. It was going in and checking them. It was changing password. Like, I trust it probably more than I should. But when you realize that like anything you're spending your time on your computer doing, that agent can also do. Execs, often when I say that, they're like, whoa, what do you mean it can control your computer? And I'll show them. I'll be like, look, here's the cursor. It's moving around. It's opening up a site. It's accessing my email. It just drafted emails. But that's one of those big gaps where technologists fundamentally understand that, like, because everything is now creating digital data, that just is a huge unlock, and executives still struggle to grasp, what does that mean? This agent can do anything I can do. Again, not the physical world. We're still humanoid robots, still early, but like in the digital world, everything is fair game. And so that's like, it's really hard to convey that to folks that aren't digital natives, like Gen Z, millennials. They get that. And 40, 50 year old execs struggle with it.
And I think especially from an exec side, because I always separate, and I think you've, and what I mean by separation, there's on the user side, and then it comes to a whole enterprise AI point, because now you have data controls, guardrails, you have identity management, and all of these other pieces that come into an organization, right? So from this side, especially from the performance labs on that, with AI now in 2026, you got the tokenomics now it's saying, okay, the cost of it now is going up. Like, I know Copilot now for GitHub Copilot is insane on the amount of how much it takes. You know, you have Fable, but now they've switched it to now it's like 50% of weekly. And so now it's the cost perspective. Does the cost ramp up? And now there's a secondary, I don't know if you've heard, Michael, now on, should we switch over to more on open source now to keep it more controlled around our data? So there's so many pieces of it. What should boards for execs, let's say for a CIO or CTO is listening to this, and they got an opportunity and they're coming on to another, you know, medium-sized company, where should they be looking more towards on making impacts in organizations, you would say?
Yeah. I mean, there's a trade-off every organization faces between pushing the envelope and innovating and sprinting at this opportunity versus being safe and secure and, you know, making sure that they're tied up with governance. And I'm not saying you can disregard that. Like, that governance conversation, it always has to be a part of the AI conversation. But my honest sense is that organizations are very much over-indexed on the governance side of things. And as a result, I think they're missing opportunities to really like that this technology presents. And we're going to see disruption. We're going to see new entrants in their field. And you need to try to be that disruptor or guard against it. Like I'll give you, here's a really concrete example. You look at procurement committees, you know, and they're responsible for technology buying decisions. And in big companies, they can take 6 to 12 months to make a decision to bring on a co-pilot. And first off, 6 to 12 months is like an eon in AI, you know, timeline. That's like dog years. That's like, oh, in 7 years, we're going to make a change. You're hamstringing the company. And especially because everyone trusts, like, I get it. Copilot, Microsoft has done a great job bundling their product and pricing it. Copilot is everywhere. But I talked to so many Copilot only shops and I can't help but think you are hamstringing your people. You're kind of forcing them to do their jobs with one hand tied behind their back. And so all this to say, the companies I've worked with that I think are being smart about this is they've created a special AI steering and procurement committee. And that allows company employees to nominate tools. They get a budget. They play around in a sandboxed environment. They don't do anything stupid. But when they find a tool that they think to themselves, oh, this is a game changer, they can fast track that application. And then, of course, they do their due diligence, but it's AI enabled. So they're able to get all that, issue an RFP if necessary. They get all that information very quickly. And they're able to make decisions not 6 to 12 months, but like 1 to 2 months down the line. So that's like a great example of, listen, if you're not changing your process to adapt to AI, you're moving slower than your competitors. And I do think those companies are going to run into their like OS moment where they're like, oh my God, we're way behind. How do we catch up? And it's like, oh, the game's kind of lost at that point. So, you know, that's my take is I don't want to be the guy who's like anti-governance and anti-privacy and anti-security, but this is... It grows exponentially. Humans don't really understand exponential growth. And you need to adjust to reflect that, like, this is on technology unlike anything we've ever encountered before.
I think even to your point now, it was even what, 3-4 months ago, it came out to where now you can do dispatch from your phone on what you can talk to from your computer. So now, as long as your computer's on, I think that. Now, even if it's off, like it can still do process. To your point, you know, Claude now has it. They put more emphasis on co-work now. So now it can really build out. I just saw this week, you can add skills for co-work. Before that was on Claude Code on the CLI side. So to your point, you're seeing so much on this side. So, you know, Michael, I know now that you've transitioned over to now working with, you're being more upfront, you're going on to keynote speakers, you're speaking to execs on the boards and on the AI performance labs. What is your definition of success for AI Lab as it continues forward? And you would say by the end of this year or next year, what would you like to see?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think our real goal is to educate and up-level executives and to make them AI fluent, literate, eventually AI native. You know, we're still early in that journey. Like I've done tons of workshops and keynotes, but this is still an early in terms of packaging that within a broader, longer term journey, right? We have a few different cohorts of execs at companies that I've worked with that trust me. And so frankly, we're like, they're testing it out now. They're seeing the results. They're really happy with it. But yeah, my goal over the next couple of years is I want to see dozens and dozens of companies that are clients of ours that trust us. I'd love to see thousands upon thousands of executives that are subscribers that are getting value from this, that are continuing to hone their skills. Yeah, that's the dream, I think. And eventually, I think right now it's very much a service business. I think there's a software component to almost kind of like I mentioned, Scribe Watch was what you're doing, and then it starts to transcribe your workflows. I think there's software that we would love to build that would provide gentle nudges, that would offer up, it's almost like Clippy from Microsoft, but like an actually useful version of it that doesn't, you know, seem dumb and antiquated. But think of it as like the AI itself coaching you how to use the AI, and it's offering up tips and it's saying, hey, I see you doing this. Here's some other ways you could be doing this, or here's a better way to form the prompt, or, you know, you seem to be doing this thing a lot. There's an agent that you could build. I'll build an agent for you or with you. you know, I'm a software guy. I do love building software. It's really fun to build a product and hand it to clients and customers and get feedback. But for now, the services has been really fun because I get to engage with people. I see the impact that I make. I meet with these execs. It puts me very closely in touch with customers, which I think is something you don't get as much when you're a developer and a builder.
Yeah. So I'm like, it's such a change for you. So when you first kind of came in on, you know, when you started getting further into the keynote speakers and you started advising more on the exec board, was it an easy transition for you? Was it just, how did you have to kind of shift over? Was the mindset a little just immediately after? How did that kind of walk me through like your metamorphosis or that transition?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I will say first off, because you were kind of asking me like, hey, what's the difference between technologists and execs? If you're, and I know you can connect to this because you're a very social guy. If you're a great technologist and developer, but you also have learned how to storytell and engage with people and take stuff from that very in the weeds level, but make it accessible to leaders, that is a super, super valuable and rare skill set. And I'm not the best in the world at it, but I do think I'm one of the unique few that can speak executive and can also speak developer. And so I'd encourage anyone that's listening, I know you've got a very tech forward audience, man, work on those skills. They're going to be even more valuable going forward. And so I think to your question, I was fortunate in that I'm just a social animal, like oldest of six, lots of fights growing up. And so I think I learned both the math and all, but also how to connect with people and how to engage with them. And, but it was a challenge to shift gears. I always liked building, but I felt like I couldn't do both very effectively. I would spend 5 hours coding. I try to preserve white space. And then I would come out of that and try to talk to even friends or my girlfriend. And I felt like a robot.
I felt the same way. Yeah. It was a big switch.
It's weird. And I'm the same guy, but like you go from talking in Python to talking in English and they're kind of the same, but like I felt very awkward. And so but I love coding. I love problem solving. I had to kind of step away and say, you know what? It's hard to do both. I felt like I had developed enough of a skill set and a client roster to focus on the latter. And so it's a little sad, like my developer skills have atrophied a bit. You know, I'd logged my 10,000 hours. I could build anything in Python. But yeah, I haven't really been a master developer in probably 2-3 years. So yeah, that was just in terms of time and where your attention is at. I realized I couldn't do both. I'm sure there are folks who are incredibly talented and skilled, but I needed to carve out time. I needed to choose. And if I'm going to be good at one of them, I'd rather be good at engaging because I think that's just more valuable given what I'm doing.
I agree too. I think it is a big switch because, you know, now everything's become so digitized, especially AI now. Now it used to be executive writing. Now you don't really need executive writing at this point. Yeah. You can have Copilot. So for on the storytelling for folks that are listening in that are more technical, even get more into leadership, they want to, it comes down to the communication and just as you point, the storytelling. So for you, when you went through that journey, did you start with just what's the pain points? And then did you kind of work in, okay, from this point on what I'm building is how do I eliminate those pain points? So how did you get into just for the folks that are listening in, what can they glean from it, at least from your experience on how do they make that small, that journey, those steps forward to getting more storytelling, to get more front-facing.
Yeah. I mean, like number one, I think technologists tend to think they'll think I'm smart if I speak very technically and I confuse them. That they'll think I'm smarter than them because I know things they don't know. I think that's the opposite. Like it's really easy to make hard things sound hard. It's hard to make hard things sound simple. So like, take it down a few notches. And as practice for that, try explaining to your dad, like I tried, you know, try to talk to your dad or someone a bit older or someone that's out of this technology loop and try to explain to them how something works. And you'll see when they're confused and like you know, or when they've checked out, when their eyes glaze over, and that's a sign that you didn't connect with them, right? So I think that's a good way to sort of practice these skills. And the other thing that I love to do in talks is, I do a lot of storytelling and I used to think, hey, as an academic, a case study of one doesn't really convey the point as well as a empirical study. No. People think in terms of stories. So even, if it's a good, well-told story, people will get it. And the other thing I do a ton of is drawing metaphors. People don't get architecture in the digital world with websites and infrastructure. They do get architecture when it comes to physical world. People understand houses, like what's a foundation and how, what I found worked is like, and I'm sure we're going to re-architect the platform. Well, I don't know what that means. Oh, it's simple. We're going to tear down one room at a time while we keep the rest of the house standing. We're going to move people from room to room. And while we do that, we're going to renovate one piece of the house at a time, right? And like, when you explain it in that way, you're like, oh, I totally get that. That makes tons of sense. So use those. It sounds kind of silly. And you're almost like, why are you explaining it to me like a child? But folks get that. And then you can go back to that metaphor. So I get really excited about this because I'm like, that's something I learned that I thought, oh, this, they're going to think I'm an idiot. And instead it was the opposite. They were like, oh, this guy is great. He understands what he's doing.
To your point, I never thought of it from a house perspective, but it makes so much sense because when you think of replatforming, in my eye, I'm like networking and I have to be like, oh, okay, as it can go down deep in the weeds. But if you just think, okay, I need to worry about how does it talk to the service? So, okay, there comes a network, like very big blocks. And then we can be able to transition that and we think of it from, I think that's the best way. And when you teach somebody, that helps you to learn. I think that for me is when I started to teach more, really to, I see where people are having the issues with, and then I can backtrack. How can I break this down even further? So I think as, to your point, Michael, as this continues, as the agentic and this AI continues to form, even in the next 2 years, man, I really think the folks that are really able to engage, really just storytelling, that's that human level on how to break through that storytelling of what's the pain point and how can I guide you to the goal or the solution to what you want for what you want for yourself. So this has been great. So I know that's been so much, you've been putting in so many like pearls of wisdom, Michael. So I appreciate the time for it. I wanted to kind of get your piece of it. What I ask usually folks that come onto the call, if you had that magic wand, what would you want AI to really accomplish? Like in the next, let's say ChatGPT 8 or Claude, Fable 7, what is a key point that you would love AI to do, whether that's on the performance lab side, on the enterprise side, or even just on the user side, on the consumer?
The thing I think a lot about, and I mentioned it earlier, is like taste. And if you think about how we've trained these models and we fed them all this data from the internet, and like threads and threads on Reddit. And I think because of that, it kind of tends towards the mean. Like it's not dumb by any means, but it takes as given that the way to build this is the way most people are building it. And so when it comes to like deck work, because I have a very, very high bar when it comes to storytelling and crafting decks. And I've really struggled with AI, and I've tried all the tools to get it to tell a story and show visuals in a way that's really visually compelling and isn't like, here's three bullet points and here are some sub bullets and here's an image in the corner. Like that's the consultant deck. I'm sure it's been trained on millions of those. I kind of throw up all over those decks because I see them and I know they don't work. And that's why I stay busy. So I would love it if it could, and it has access to my decks and it understands my style, but I still haven't been able to train the AI to be a storyteller in the way that I am. And I haven't been able to say, these are tons of decks that I've delivered along with the voiceover and the sound, what I would say, the narration. Can you build a deck in my style? Or could you even suggest an outline that would tell a story in a compelling way? And I'm constantly pushing the envelope. I'm constantly testing. I'll reach out to you, Solomon, as soon as they've cracked that nut. The good news is I'm not out of a job for the foreseeable future, because like that's still a skill set I have. But it's been wrestling with the AI. Be like, no, like this is lame. They're not going to get engaged. They're going to think this is a consultant's deck. That's not what I do. So that's like I said, it's taste, right? It's like don't aim for the middle. Try to replicate what I do. I think I'm very good at that.
So do you think they're starting, like, you know, the bigger companies are starting to do that, like on Claude Design, or now with, when in terms of building out websites, do you think that's that we're starting to see that approach with that storytelling as it goes further, you would say, or is it still quite not there?
Yeah, the answer is yes. I've gotten there. I've gotten close in hacky ways, which is first give me a outline. Like, let's walk me through kind of a flow, right? In Claude, using Fable. And then once we've got there, suggest some, mind blowing visual examples. Forget about sourcing any content. Just tell me what are the visuals. And then you feed that to design and you kind of babysit it while it does the job. And sometimes it gets it right. Sometimes it gets it wrong. So, you know, and then I'll hammer it with a critic and I'll say, okay, what do you not like about this? What's boring? Where are you going to? So I can do that in like this 4 or 5 part way. And maybe I'm just being lazy and I just want the deck to just generate and to be beautiful and compelling and have visuals and animations. But yeah, we're absolutely getting there. And I will say Claude Design is insane. And I'm in there all the time and I don't have a designer bone in my body. So it's been a game changer for deck work. But it's, you know, one day they'll figure out how to combine all of those skill sets.
I think so too. I think it's just phenomenal just on how crazy I just still remember back from the Super Bowl from last year. And I remember the big switch on how far this is. AI has really changed in the matter of just a year. Like, it's been insane. So Michael, thank you so much for coming on. For folks that are, for listeners that are coming on, they want to learn more about AI Performance Labs and just really follow on, you know, your keynote speaking. Where can they learn more or, you know, check out Performance Labs to see if their company is a right fit for them? Can you tell us where?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me speaking, you can look at my website. It's michaelhousman.com. Last name spelled Housman, no E. There's the lab, AI, performancelab.ai. If you want to see, get a sense of our offering and kind of explore whether there's a fit there, I encourage you to find me on LinkedIn. I'm always posting interesting content. I've got a newsletter. And then above my shoulder, hopefully folks can see there's a book. It's called Future Proof, Transform Your Business with AI or Get Left Behind. Pick it up. It's $25. It's a much cheaper and more in-depth way of seeing what I present on stages. I've distilled what I've been doing the last 8 years and making it really accessible to audiences. So yeah, all those are ways to engage with me and you know, feel free to reach out. I love these conversations. I probably make myself more available than I should to folks that are interested in my ideas.
No, we've got so much into your background at Amperform. We didn't even touch into your book. So I know we'll have to find a time because I know you're going to be busy with the traveling to I have to grab it, read it, and really have a time where we can really dive into the future proof, really see. So I'd love to have that next time.
Yeah, I'd love that. Yeah, I'll come back and we'll talk more.
Perfect. So for folks that are listening in, you'll have all of Dr. Michael's links for AI Performance Labs, for his LinkedIn. If you want to check that out, we'll have those hyperlinks down the bottom. So Michael, thank you again for coming on. So really look forward to having more conversations, especially on the book next time, hopefully.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is a great conversation.
Take care, everyone. We'll catch you on the next episode of the AI Advantage.
Thanks for tuning in to the AI Advantage. If this episode sparked an idea, share it with your network. Subscribe for more no-fluff conversations on how smart tech drives real outcomes. And if you're ready to future-proof your business, let's connect at salonox.net.